I call this meeting of the House Education Policy Committee to order. Members, please take your seats. And we have a quorum. And we didn't get a chance to do our minutes last time, so we have two sets of minutes. Has anybody had a chance to look at the minutes from Wednesday, March 6th? I believe these are the ones we fixed with some corrections.
I move the minutes, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Kunesh-Boudin moves the minutes from Wednesday, March 6th. Any discussion on that motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? The minutes have been adopted for Wednesday, March 6th. And then Friday, March 8th. Has anybody had a chance to look at the minutes?
I will move them as well, March 8th.
Representative Mary Kunesh-Boudin moves the minutes for Friday, March 8th. Any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The minutes have been adopted for Friday, March 8th. All right, members, we have just a few bills up today. House File 1572 and House File 578, we're going to take up first, and then we'll roll into the omnibus bill, which is House File 1711. It's my hope today to walk through the bill, take any quick questions on what's in the bill from members, but limit it so we can get to testimony first. And hear the majority of the testimony today. We're going to take a break probably after walking through and before testimony for lunch, depending on what time we're at, for like 30 minutes. I'm hoping to get done between 2:30 and 3 today. I know there's members that have to duck in and out for other meetings, but today we'll take the majority of the testimony and finishing up testimony tomorrow during committee and then moving on to amendments on Wednesday and Thursday. So with that, do we have, Representative Sandell, would you like to present House File 1572? Representative Sandell, would you like to move House File 1572 before the committee?
I would, Chair Yoakim. Thank you very much. I move that the House File 1572 be moved. Thank you.
Thank you. We have House File 1572 before it, and the motion is going to be to send it to Education Finance. So, Representative Sandell, would you like to proceed and describe your bill?
Well, good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thanks very much for this opportunity to ask your support for House File 1572. Our bill supports the National Youth Leadership Council's work promoting service learning projects across Minnesota. All of us who have taught school cherish the moments that have inspired our students, provided them with a broader understanding of the world, and given them a sense of success and accomplishment. While I worked with the St. Paul Public Schools Learning Centers project, our curriculum was based on the concept and the practice of service learning. Our students were directed by their teachers, worked on community organizations with neighborhood groups, professionals in the areas of city planning, environmental awareness, social services, public service television production, and agencies throughout the city, where their contributions could make a genuine contribution and difference in the world they worked in and the people they served. The experiences offered both students and teachers a real sense of special satisfaction and accomplishment and a personal sense of relevance and understanding. I've asked two individuals with experience in service learning programs across the country to talk with you about the bill, about the opportunities that this bill offers. Dr. Joe Nathan has been a friend of mine for more than 40 years. He's worked in small neighborhood schools as well as organizations with influence such as the Gates Foundation to bring educational choice and opportunities in service learning to students around the country. Greg Herter is board chair of the National Youth Leadership Council, a Minnesota nonprofit with a 35-year history of partnering with organizations throughout the state, influencing civic education and vocational preparations throughout the country. I hope they'll give you a chance to understand how important service learning may be to our communities, our students, and our schools. Thank you. Dr. Nathan.
Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Joe Nathan. I've been a public school teacher and administrator, PTA president, and honorary member of the state PTA here in Minnesota. We have three children and five grandchildren. The three children have all graduated from the St. Paul Public Schools, and the five granddaughters are all in the St. Paul Public Schools at this point. I've been married to a public school teacher for more than 33 years. I approach the issue today first with a single document that's in front of you about what happened in Cincinnati about 9 years ago. This column from the Star Tribune points out that Cincinnati was able, with our help, to not just reduce but eliminate graduation achievement gaps between white and African-American students over a five-year period. This made it one of the very few public school urban districts in the country which has been able to do this. And there were 10 steps that were taken to accomplish this elimination of the graduation gap, which when we started was more than 25 points. And one of those key strategies was community schools, which this committee has already discussed. And one of those strategies was service learning. Service learning, in my view, having worked on these issues for more than 45 years as a public school teacher and administrator, is one of the central, not the only, but one of the central components of making significant progress, both for all students and for students who are from low income and from communities of color. Because it says it is not just about getting more social workers and more youth workers, and those are important to help families and to help youngsters, but it's not just about that. It's also about helping young people see that they can help make a difference. I want to briefly allude to a second document in front of you prepared by a vice president at the University of Minnesota, which summarizes the research. But I want to finally, in the next probably 60 seconds, ask that you think about me not as the person that you see in front of you, but as this young man with whom I began to work about 35 years. He is, as you can see, African-American young man who came to the school where I taught, a public school in St. Paul. And I will briefly summarize what he had to say in his description of a service learning project. He says, his name is David Ellis. He has founded and directed a school about 10 minutes from this room, so wasn't able to join us this morning. He was pretty rebellious growing up. He would challenge systems. He used to be confrontational. He got kicked out of two public schools here in St. Paul. Then he transferred to another district school. A teacher asked him, do you want to learn how to protect your rights and money? And that tapped into his interest to help other people. He learned as a part of that coursework how to read and understand various documents, but he also learned how he could make a difference by actually solving consumer problems that adults referred to him. He learned about collaboration. He learned that he could make a difference. And he said to the teacher, who happened to be me, after his name and his face appeared in the newspaper, the newspaper article is on the back of the piece of paper, he said, you know, Joe, I often thought I might have my name in the paper. I even thought I might have my picture in the paper, but I never thought it would be for something good. This young man had his life transformed in part by learning that he could make a positive difference in the world, combining classroom work and community service. This bill, which incidentally we can, after conversations with the Senate author and with bipartisan support, we can reduce by reducing the number, the cost, by reducing the number of startup grants that are provided, on reducing the number of meetings from around the state, which we've proposed initially from 4 to 3, because we want to include people from throughout the state. We want to make sure that everybody has a chance to come to the meetings that are proposed. And by the way, none of this money will go out of state. It will all be used to help teachers and educators and students learn from each other here in Minnesota. But this bill provides opportunities. It provides an important part of, not the only, but an important part of what we think is significant progress for all youngsters in Minnesota and significant progress in helping to reduce and indeed eliminate key graduation, other forms of gaps among kids of different communities. Thanks for considering the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Nathan. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Greg Herger. I'm a Blaine resident. I am a classroom teacher veteran of 25 years working with both talented and gifted students and also high need at-risk students in the Minneapolis alternative school community. For the past 7 years, I was the service learning coordinator at Moundsview Public Schools, and am currently the board chair of National Youth Leadership Council. They've been around 35 years. They didn't invent service learning, but they've been at the forefront of promoting, formalizing, and advocating for the practice, both in Minnesota and nationally and internationally. Adding to what Joe said, I want to just make three quick points in respect of your time. The first point is that service learning was very popular in the 90s and the 2000s as something of its own. It has since been embraced by and embedded in other instructional techniques that have high publicity. For example, STEM, the best STEM programs nationwide, from pre-K to 5, makerspaces all the way up to MIT's Innovation Lab, have elements of service learning and service learning philosophy embedded in it. Civic education, experiential civic education, has an awful lot of service learning principles and techniques and practices embedded in it. That's a sign of a mature and accepted technique and educational model. However, there's a downside to that, which is as it's been embedded in these other instructional approaches, the discrete training and professional development for service learning has been somewhat minimized. It's become part of something else. And that's a problem because service learning really involves turning things over to students, and teachers need specific training in how to manage those dynamics. And sometimes it gets overlooked. Second point, which this bill would help to remedy for sure by putting a spotlight on the service learning, we would expect folks that apply for the grants in this bill would be representative of some of those other instructional models. The second point I'd like to make is this bill is two-thirds devoted to resources for Greater Minnesota. And as somebody who has been on the board, not just of NYLC, but other groups that do professional development and statewide professional development conferences, resources and professional development for Greater Minnesota oftentimes have access issues. We wanted, in writing this bill, to devote the lion's share of those resources to districts and other educational entities in Greater Minnesota to try and bridge that gap. The last point I wanted to make is a note on return on investment. A 2009 study that's referenced in your handout took a survey of service learning programs nationally across many different iterations, and found that your average return on investment was $1 generated for of impact to the community. So it's a 1-4 return on investment. I can testify to this in my personal experience as service learning coordinator at MonsU, just with two programs. Our district-wide organic gardening project in Mounds View generated a 1-6 return on investment. $1 put in by the district to continue the program produced 6 in benefit to the community through produce donations to food shelves, not to mention the educational pieces as well, and impact on students involved in the program, which were, over at the time I departed Mounds View, was over a quarter of the student population was involved in that programming. Our high school service and community engagement programs over the course of 5 years yielded a return on investment of $1 to $42. $1 of support to $42 benefits the community. Service learning has many such benefits when it's done well and done in coordination with a diversity of outside groups, and that's important. If we're working to provide opportunities for our students not to just prepare for what life's going to be like as adults and as college students, we have to get ahead of it and put them in those situations early and train them to collaborate across difference, to use and apply their learning in ways that can point to vocational development and civic development. And with that, I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Herder. Representative Sindel, did you have any further comments or any other testifiers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the testimony has been strong and supportive. We talk a lot in this committee about involvement and investment in our communities. We talk about equality and equity and opportunity, and we talk a lot about civic education. Service learning, in my experience, has provided instruction in history, politics, economics, technology, industry, and social interaction. It's a real opportunity for student decision-making and, I think, a real step toward democracy in education. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for considering our bill.
Thank you. And is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Wonderful. And then I think we'll go to member questions first. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sandell, on line 1.10, I think you want to change subdivision 4 to subdivision 5 because your startup grants don't match up with what's on page 2. And also, I think on line 1.13, you need subdivision 6, not subdivision 5, because you're talking about evaluation. Am I correct?
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, I think you probably are correct. Yes, ma'am.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Sandel, you might want to make those corrections.
Thank you, ma'am.
Representative Erickson, we'll make sure that we note those down for when it goes to Ed Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a follow-up. On the Cincinnati model, I visited Cincinnati when they were going through this, or the public schools, one of them, I should say, when they were going through this transformation, Mr. Nathan. And, you know, when they started this transformation, what they really focused on was school leadership. And I remember they brought in an ex-military, or former military, I shouldn't call him ex-military, to become principal of one of the schools that started this movement to turn them around. And so, you know, based on the comments you've made in your handout, which I think are very good, I think the fact that they empowered schools to select faculty, there was no job guarantee based on seniority, they brought in dynamite school leaders, they partnered with colleges, I think those are the successes that Cincinnati began to see to turn around and close their achievement gap. So I just wanted to put that on the record because service learning is important, yes, but the main focus should be on what you do with school leadership and with training teachers to move schools to a point where they can close the achievement gap that exists among their students or with the disparity that exists among cultures that I know is true in Cincinnati. So I just wanted to get that on the record, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Sandel, any comments on that?
Madam Chair, thanks very much. Representative Erickson, I certainly agree with you that collaboration, partnering, training, and leadership are enormously important in the project. And I don't know if Mr. Nathan or Mr. Herter have additional comments.
Gentlemen, does anybody have any additional comments? Dr. Nathan, proceed.
Madam Chair, Representative, just a 30-second agreement. If you look at point 9, it's give principals authority and hold them accountable for results. If
Absolutely.
You look at point 4, it's focus workshops for teachers in these reading, writing. So we agree. I mean, the service learning was an important, but certainly not the only, but not the only thing. There's also an element of empowering the educators. The educators at the school level were allowed to create new schools within schools. So we agree.
Thank you, Mr. Herter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Erickson. I will also agree and offer a slight bit of testimony from my own personal experience. My first 12 years in Minnesota was working with Minnesota Minneapolis Alternative Schools in Phillips and Seward neighborhoods. First working, running an American Indian Magnet School and then working for the VOA schools. In those situations, exactly right. You know, the alternative schools were non-union shops.
Representative Erickson, follow up?
Non-union shops. And as a result, we were able to choose our own. However, there is a freedom involved in that that has spread, I think, beyond kind of your more independent schools to institute service learning in ways that have also added to the kind of outcomes that you're talking about. When I was working for VOA, using a very strong outward bound and service learning model, we were able to narrow the achievement gap. And these are for students that had pretty much been kicked out of the major, the mainline Minneapolis public schools. We were able to narrow the achievement gap amongst African American and Hispanic students, and we also raised our college application percentages by 25% over 2 years. And some of that occurred because of service learning programs that were done in conjunction and in partnership with higher education institutions around the Twin Cities with Concordia University and others. By putting students into those collaborative situations, it opened vistas for them. And we had the freedom to do that. If you want to look at the, kind of your ultimate expression of what service learning can do under enlightened leadership, look to Breck and Blake schools that have done fantastic work with service learning within that system. However, We have STEM. We have these civic education programs now that are very much part of the public system and greatly benefit, again, from that real-life applied learning experience and collaboration with others. Without that element, you risk things like STEM that should be exciting for students becoming just another way of doing school, becoming a hypothetical.
Thank you. Any further member questions? Seeing none, the motion to, I renew the motion for House File 1572 to go to Ways and Means with the intention of it going to Ed Finance. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed? House File 1572 is on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lean, are you ready for your bill? Representative Kunesh-Podein, would you like to move House File 578 before us?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would like to move 578 for possible...
Moving it to Ways and Means.
To Ways and Means.
And Representative Lean, I see that you have, is the A1 amendment yours?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Would you like to move the A1 amendment? Have the A1 amendment moved?
Yes.
I move the A1 amendment, the author's amendment. Would you like to speak to your amendment quickly?
Yes. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I appreciate you hearing House File 578. And, Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to have a hearing over here in the Capitol. I haven't been over here yet, in the office building. So.
This is a new experience for us, too. Second time. House File 8, A1 is before, the amendment coded A1 is before us. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The A1 amendment's been adopted. The bill's in the shape you'd like. Would you like to proceed?
Thank you. Just to speak to the amendment a little bit, it is based on some concerns from the Department of Revenue. Early on, we had planned to make some changes to how the tax credit and the related credit assignment was administered, but we have decided just to focus on the household income limits in the bill. And the amendment just takes away some of the administrative provisions that the Department of Revenue would have had to undergone. So that was where that came
and
from.
And Representative Lean, I just realized we are actually going to be moving this to the Tax Committee in that Ways and Means. So would you like to proceed with your testimony?
Thank you. House File 578 is a fairly simple, straightforward bill. Its goal is to restore eligibility for the K-12 education credit to the families it was initially intended to serve, and this is simply a statute update. The credit covers 75% of the cost of after-school enrichment activities, driver's education and some purchases, and rentals of musical equipment, computer hardware, and software. The current household limit to claim the credit is a max of $33,500, regardless of child size, and that's to claim the maximum credit of $1,000. This limit has not changed since the tax credit was enacted in '97, and clearly it has not kept up with the times and is in need of some updating. The bill would benchmark the household income limit to eligibility for free and reduced lunch. In short, basically, it means that a family who we have already determined is in need of assistance paying for school lunch would also be able to qualify for assistance paying for some of these after-school programs. In real dollars, this means that, for example, a family with two parents and one child, the income limit would be $38,443. And for a family with three kids, the limit would increase to $54,427. This credit is truly a statewide credit, as it does impact people in all 87 counties. 45% of filers claiming the credit and nearly 44% of the amount of the credit claimed came from outside the 7-county metro. Nearly 2/3 of filers claiming the credit also came from outside Hennepin and Ramsey, again demonstrating that this bill will impact people across the state. I'm very proud to carry this bill to make it a little easier for families around the state to be able to afford a lot of these after-school activities for their kids, and I will stand for questions or allow the testifiers to give comments.
Go ahead and have your testifiers state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
My name is Matt Norris. I'm the director of Minnesota After School Advance. I want to thank you for the opportunity to come before you today to testify in favor of House File 578. I'd also like to express my appreciation to Representative Lean for serving as our chief author, as well as our many co-authors, including several of the members of this committee. Minnesota After School Advance is a collaboration between Youth Prize and Venn Foundation that aims to help low-income families in Minnesota utilize the K-12 education credit to pay for educational, fine arts, and performing arts after-school programs. As Representative Lean mentioned, the household income limit for the maximum K-12 education credit has not changed in over 20 years. As a result, there's about 100,000 fewer families who are eligible today for this credit than when it was enacted back in 1997. And as a quick aside, I actually, in meeting with members, learned that Representative Robbins, back before she was in the legislature, actually helped to get this tax credit enacted back in 1997. And she offers her support for it and wanted to be here today, but schedules are tight this week at the Capitol. This bill offers multiple benefits. The first is that it adjusts the household income limit to really restore eligibility to those families that this credit was originally intended to serve. Two, it makes the credit more equitable by factoring in household size. And three, it makes it easier for families to determine eligibility. Currently, there's about a 1.5-page definition of household income in the statute that families have to navigate to determine eligibility. On the other hand, families generally know whether they're eligible for free and reduced lunch. So we think that using that as the benchmark for eligibility will significantly increase utilization of this credit. This credit is an important tool that helps families statewide pay for activities like math tutoring, dance classes, STEM camps, piano lessons, and driver's ed. It gives families the choice and the flexibility to select the activities that are the best fit for their children. And it's available to families and communities across Minnesota. Our organization partners with families and organizations in some of the lowest income neighborhoods in Minneapolis and St. Paul, but also suburban and exurban communities and cities in greater Minnesota. And to that end, I wanted to highlight a couple of pieces of written testimony before you today from folks in greater Minnesota who weren't able to join us. Two of them are students who have been able to pursue their love for music as a result of this tax credit. One is a 15-year-old from Northfield who's in our program. She and her two siblings are able to do piano lessons as a result of this tax credit. She talks in her testimony about her brother who suffers from cerebral palsy, uses this as a form of physical therapy to help his condition. Through the tax credit, the family is able to save about $1,800 a year. And without the tax credit, these three kids likely would not be able to be in piano lessons. Another is a student from the Grand Rapids area. He talks about how when he started at a new high school that didn't have an orchestra program, he worried about whether he'd be able to continue to learn how to play the viola. But this tax credit has allowed him to participate in an extracurricular orchestra program in his area to continue developing his skills. And finally, we have written testimony from the executive director of the Itasca Orchestra and Strings Program. She talks about how there are many families she works with who need this assistance but no longer qualify for this outdated income limit, and how using free and reduced lunch as the income benchmark would dramatically simplify things for families and increase utilization. The biggest barrier we hear from organizations and families across the state is consistent. The income limit is too low. We have families that qualify for many other types of public assistance but don't qualify for this particular tax credit. While the cost of this bill, we're still waiting for the revenue note, but we anticipate that it's not going to be insignificant. We feel like two decades of inaction have left us with a lot of catching up to do, and that the impact of young people participating in after-school programs, as well as the benefits to our state from a better trained and well-prepared workforce, make this a worthwhile investment for our community and our state. For these reasons, I strongly urge you to support House File 578. Thank you.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Erin Bailey. I'm the Director of Community Services for Northfield Public Schools. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of House File 578. As an educational professional, I firmly believe that learning should not stop when the bell rings or that when the school day ends, and we bid farewell to students at the end of the school year. That's why access to after-school and summer programming, like the programs we offer through community services, are so important. Unfortunately, for many families, cost is a barrier to accessing these valuable learning opportunities. Over the summer, low-income students lose significant ground compared to their more affluent peers. Two-thirds of the income-based achievement gap has been attributed to summer learning loss by the start of high school. By sixth grade, middle school kids have spent approximately 6,000 more hours learning than their lower-income peers. Community Services does provide $100 annually in scholarships to each child who qualifies for free or reduced-price lunches. This is to assist families in being able to access our programming. Due to the cost of some of the classes, especially those in the area of arts, these dollars are spent fast, meaning that many children need to choose between one or potentially two classes to participate in for the entire year. In addition, our scholarship dollars do not cover driver education. Driver education programming is especially important for low-income students, as it provides a means to support their families by either having transportation for that student to go to their job or being able to provide transportation for a family member. With scholarship dollars limited and always at risk of disappearing as funders' priorities shift or pools of money dry up, consistent resources to help low-income families afford these programs are vital. The K-12 Educational Tax Credit fills this void and can provide families with much-needed financial assistance to afford after-school programming. However, as several testifiers have emphasized today, the income limit for this bill is too low for many families to access the financial support. That's why Northfield Public Schools and I enthusiastically support increasing the household income limit. In addition, the Minnesota Music Teachers Association has also endorsed this bill as well. I never want any child to be denied access to programming because of cost. This is why I hope that you will vote in favor of House File 578.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey. Representative Lean, do you have another test fire?
Wonderful. Yes, Madam Chair.
Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Marcus Pope, Vice President of Youth Prize. I'm pleased to be here this morning to support HF 578. Youth Prize is a statewide organization founded by the McKnight Foundation in 2010. Our goal is really to level the playing field so that all young people in our community can thrive. We're one of the largest funders exclusively dedicated to supporting young people across the state, their education, their access to jobs and economic opportunities, as well as their health and safety. We connected with the Venn Foundation in last year, about a year ago. Jeff Oates is in the audience. He's the CEO of the Venn Foundation. And he really brought the idea of really how can we increase access to the K-12 education credit to Youth Prizes, to the forefront of Youth Prize. And we jumped right in. And what we're doing together is we're leveraging private dollars in order to increase access. As you know, the credit, you have to pay up front, and many low-income families within these income guidelines don't have the resources to pay up front. So we're mobilizing the broader community, investors who are concerned about education. So this is a true public-private partnership that we're helping to facilitate with this credit. I don't want to get into the details of why we need to adjust the guidelines. I think the previous testimony was wonderful in that regard. But Youth Prize, we're all in this. We're a major funder. We also play another role in terms of ensuring quality programming. So we work very closely with the Department of Education to ensure that when assignment is used, that parents and families have high-quality options. And we help facilitate that process. So thank you for your time today. Be happy to answer any questions. I just really hope you support this and include it in your move it to tax, and they include it in their omnibus tax bill.
Thank you, Mr. Pope. Representative Lean, any follow-up words, or we'll open it up to see if anybody else wants to testify.
Madam Chair, members, I appreciate you hearing the bill, and I ask for your support on the bill. Thank you.
Anybody else wish to testify on this bill? Any member questions? Representative Kunesh-Budin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward. I know up in Moorhead, where you are, there's a great performing arts program, Main Street, Trollwood, Performing Arts. My sister lives up there, and so we've been up there every year for probably 25 years to see those kind of performances, and they're spectacular. I mean, they're some of the best performances I've ever seen. And I'm wondering if this would benefit those students, those young people that would like to, you know, be part of that performance, not only the theatrical part of it, but also the musical orchestra sort of thing. So would parents be able to use this credit in order to allow their or get their kids into a program like that?
Representative Lee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. To my understanding, yes, they would. That program would qualify for use of these credits.
Yep. Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, this is a great program. I personally have experience working with youth, and I also have experience with telling families that we no longer have funds available for your child. It's one of the saddest days that I've ever experienced as that director. I'm concerned because this is a tax credit, and like you said, you have to pay up front before there's any, you know, you get this on April 14th, the latest, right? Have we gone far enough with this? Is there any other programs we can get so all, I mean, one of our values is that all kids get a great education, and I'm concerned that we're not doing enough here. Is this just a stepping stone to the next?
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think my testifier may have some more information about other programs out there. But as far as this bill is concerned, I think this is a good way to improve the credit, make it a better so more families can access it, just update it more or less. And, you know, like I say, my testifier may have more information about some additional programs out there for families.
Madam Chair, real quick, back to the representative there. So what I'm looking at, Representative Lean, is that to basically survive in Minnesota, according to the studies that we use as realtors, you have to make between $25 and $30 an hour to just pay the rent, get the groceries, and hopefully fill the gas tank up. That's no Walt Disney World or anything like that. At $4,000 a year, you're right at that threshold at $25 an hour. So that was my concern, kind of. Are we hitting enough families with this, and should we be higher? So that's kind of where I'm going, but this is your next testimony.
Mr. Norris, did you want to respond?
Yeah.
Or Representative Lean?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Hewitt, thanks for the question. I'll address both points that you raised. First on the piece of, you know, families having to pay for the activities up front and then waiting for it to come back in their tax refund. I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of one of the key issues with that. And that's what Marcus was referring to as well. That's what Minnesota After School Advance helps to address. We've, through the help of donors, created a loan pool that we can make no-interest loans to the families so that they can pay for those activities up front. And then there's a process with the Department of Revenue that allows us, when they file their taxes each year, to have that money come back into the loan pool and can be recycled year over year to help families access those programs. So we are working to address that piece of it. In terms of the eligibility limit, I think one of the things we're trying to be conscious of is the cost of the bill. It, like I said, hasn't been increased in 20 years, and so we've got a lot of catching up to do. I think ideally we'd love to see it be even higher, but we're also trying to be fiscally responsible in terms of at least, you know, moving the ball somewhat down the field and potentially seeing it increase even further down the road to bring it further in line with the needs of Minnesota families.
Thank you. Mr. Pope.
Madam Chair, Representative Hewitt, you know, I share your experience in terms of leading youth programs and experiencing decline and not being able to serve everybody. Back in 2003, our state unallocated funds for after school, and we've never been able to restore those funds. And then we've seen our corporate community, given their global position, go more global in terms of their funding and their philanthropy, which was focused on kids. And so that's what makes this tax credit more urgent than ever. When you couple that with some of the huge disparities we have in education, the achievement gap, the opportunity gap, this is a tool where the resources are there. We just need to make it available to those who it was originally intended to serve. And that's all we have to do. There's more that's needed, but this is a great step, and it seems like a step that we can take.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt, follow up, and then Representative Tierman.
Thank you, and that's great. You're getting where I want to go with it, and I appreciate that, and thanks for all your hard work on this, and thanks, Representative Lean, for carrying the bill. Madam Chair, I'm done.
Representative Bierman.
And I just want to echo that as well. I appreciate you bringing the bill forward, Representative Lean. And like you said, it's an improvement. It's an update where it needs to be on the tax credit portion. And then it's great to see community leaders who are out there, like Ms. Bailey, on taking charge and making sure, drawing people in and identifying those kids that need it and getting them involved. But the tax credit is great. And Representative Hewitt hit the nail on the head, as you said, about it's not enough, but we have to do what we can, and this whole updating is an important role. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Morris, I'm looking at the actual statute and disturbed by who is allowed to get this fee or tuition in music, because you have to either be a licensed teacher or a member of the Minnesota Music Teachers Association. And I think in rural Minnesota, we have those who are teaching piano lessons who are neither of those, who are excellent. So that is a little disturbing. And in fact, Ms. Pera, I think this is some language we should look at updating, because it's written very awkwardly. And then you can't be related to the student. And, I don't think this language has been updated for a while, but in rural Minnesota, to have a teacher who's either part of the MMTA or licensed, because I used to teach piano lessons, of course I'm a licensed teacher, but not in music. So my students could qualify for this. This is several years ago, but I'm just a little bothered by that, just so you know. And Representative Lean, I'm not sure you knew that's how it was written.
Representative Lean or Mr. Norris?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, it's a good point. One other way that teachers or instructors can qualify is if they have a bachelor's degree. That's another way that they can qualify under the statute. But the overall point you raise is a valid one. It's actually a challenge we've run into as we're trying to expand our program in Greater Minnesota. We certainly would be interested in revisiting that language at some point to try to open up access.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad that he noticed that.
Representative Wazlawick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a question. I just want to speak in support of this bill. I work in before and after school child care, and we interface with a lot of those after school programs, and so know how important they are to the kids, and know the cool things that I never got to do, like robotics and Lego camp and all these sorts of things that we're running in our district. And I think that it's really important that we have these opportunities. Keeps kids busy, maybe sparks an interest that they didn't know they had, and could lead to perhaps going into a STEM field or something later on. So I think it's really important that we do what we can to help families access these programs.
Thank you, Representative Wazlawick. Any other further questions? Okay, Representative Lean, final word.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members.
The motion has been for House File 578 as amended to move to taxes. Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? The motion to move House File 578 has passed, and it's on their way. Has been adopted, and it's on the way to taxes. So with that, members, I am going to move to the testifiers table to present House File 1711. And then when we start to go through testimony, I'm just going to come up here to help manage testimony again after that. So switch spots here. Oh, and Christina Parra is going to come up with me as well.
All
All right, while Chair Yawakim is getting settled, members, we have House File 1711 up for consideration this morning. I will preside while Chair Yawakim presents her bill. Chair Yawakim, would you like to move your bill to get it before the committee?
I will as soon as I switch chairs. Sorry, the lever is not working on that one. So I'd like to move House File 1711 before the committee with the intention of it going to Ways and Means.
Okay, so moved. We have the bill before us.
Actually, we have a DE1.
Okay, members, the author has an amendment labeled H1711DE1 to get the bill in shape. She would like to hear it. Chair Yawakim, would you like to move your author's amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would. I would like to move the DE1 amendment.
All right. Chair Yawakim has moved DE1 amendment. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Chair Yawakim, would you like to provide testimony on the bill, please?
Yes, thank you. So thank you, Madam Chair and members. Now that we've adopted the amendment, the bill's in the right shape, and I want to thank you for your attention today and all the work that's gone into this. What you see before us is the culmination of the weeks we've spent together since session has started. So far, we've had about 136 bills sent to our committee, and we've heard roughly 40 of them. We've heard bills regarding special education paperwork, how teachers are licensed, tweaks to the board that does the licensing, and ways to increase teachers of color in our classroom. We've heard bills that would require increased training for our teachers and school staff around mental health, suicide prevention, dyslexia, and much more. We've also heard bills regarding comprehensive sexual education and student press freedom, as well as requiring added credits in civics education and financial literacy. And we've also heard changes to current policies, mostly non-controversial, and how we can best deliver education to our students. There's been robust discussions had, and while we didn't always agree, it remained respectful, and I truly do appreciate that. I wanted to have as many voices come to the table as possible during our short time together, and I believe we have accomplished that as well. As members, we all brought interests and issues forward that we wanted to tackle, and the bills we heard gave us a variety of solutions to do just that. My ultimate goal in putting this bill together was to make sure that our schools have the tools to meet our students' needs. And over our time together, we found that we can agree that those needs are great and that times have changed. I also wanted to find balance. This bill is a combination of 35 of our members' bills plus provisions from the governor's policy bill. There are 25 DFL member bills represented and 10 Republicans. Not everyone is going to love everything in this bill, but I'm sure everyone can find something in here that they'll like. Despite our best efforts, there were a few things that were accidentally left out. We will incorporate those into an author's amendment. Christina Perez already started to draft that amendment for me. So far, it includes two small provisions from the governor's bill I forgot to include regarding study abroad and charter school authorizers, and includes compromised language on the foster care provision, a tweak on the Pelsby language on lines 37.17, and I forgot to add one of Representative Erickson's provisions to require background checks for teachers upon licensure renewal. I would like to wait to present that amendment until Wednesday, when we have completed testimony, as there may be a few other small adjustments to language that folks may suggest. I would like to thank nonpartisan staff for all of the work they've put in as we have assembled this quality piece of legislation. None of this could have happened without the hard work of Christina Parra, Tim Strom, and Emily Andrees. We're going to have Christina Parra walk through the bill, and then afterwards I would like to return to the chair position as we work through testimony. And then we will take testimony until about 3 with a break in between. I'm pretty sure we won't get all the testimony in for those who wish to testify and may need to take some time tomorrow, but we'll keep that time within our regular committee time, so there won't be an evening hearing tomorrow night. And then Wednesday we'll start on amendments just during the day and then finish up on Thursday. And during amendments, of course, I'll have Representative Kunesh put in chair. So now I'd like to turn it over to Christina Parra, who will walk through the bill, and afterwards, if folks have quick or clarifying questions on what's included in the bill, I'll take those, and then we'll move to testimony. Madam Chair, members, just go through each article. Section 1 allows an initial serving school district to continue to provide transportation services to and from a cooperative program for a homeless student with an individualized education program who changes school districts during the year. It allows the initial district and the currently serving school district to mutually agree on an alternative transportation agreement. Section 2 relates to students in foster care and requires a student in foster care to be enrolled in school within 7 school days of being placed in a foster home. It allows a student that is already enrolled in a district to remain enrolled in the district even if the foster home is in a different district. Section 3 requires a school district to provide annual notice to the parents of the district parents of the district's policy on student absences for religious observance. Section 4 allows a school board to consider the community's religious observance when it determines the school calendar. Section 5 requires a district to provide kindergarten. Section 6 makes technical changes to the superintendent statute, just adds some, breaks the subdivision up into paragraphs. Section 7 expands the definition of textbooks to include teacher's edition, guide, or other materials that a pupil uses when the teacher's edition or guide or other materials are required to be purchased for student use. And that language is slightly different from what we heard in committee after consulting with the department. And so it's the same intent, but just slightly differently worded. Section 8 was also part of that bill, as well as Section 9. Section 8 expands the definition of individualized instructional or cooperative learning materials to include the teacher materials. And Section 9 makes technical changes and eliminates obsolete language. Section 10 requires the school board to take charge of and control all extracurricular activities and to reserve revenue raised for extracurricular activities and spend the revenue only for extracurricular activities. Section 11 strikes language that prohibits a district from using the fees from an all-day kindergarten program on programs for 3- and 4-year-old children. School districts now receive state money for all-day kindergarten, so that relates to that. Section 12 requires applicants for grants administered by the Commissioner of Education to include in their applications a statement of the goals for the grant, which should be allowed to the World's Best Workforce Goals or the state ESSA plan goals. Applicants are required to include strategies used to meet the goals and a plan to measure the effectiveness and to report to the commissioner on the effectiveness of the strategies. Section 13 allows school districts to start before Labor Day in the 2021 and 21-22 school year. Section 14 repeals 127A14, which relates to Commissioner of Education purchase of annuity for employees. Section 2 is education excellence, and the first 4 sections you see there relate to the bill to lower the age of compulsory instruction to begin at 6 rather than 7. So each of those sections just makes conforming changes to the statute. Section 5 combines 2 bills. It modifies the graduation requirements to require at least 1/2 credit for a course in personal finance and require a course for credit in government and citizenship in either 11th or 12th grade to be included within the social studies credits. And one typo that I'm going to note is that that should say 6.5 elective credits rather than 6. We will fix that. Sections 6 and 7 modify the world's best 2 subdivisions in the world's best workforce statute. The first is plans and budgets, and the second is district advisory committee. And both of those were from Representative Kunesh-Budin's Teachers of Color, an American Indian bill. So they add language regarding access to a culturally relevant or ethnic studies curriculum, inclusive and respectful learning and work environments, and retaining qualified, racially and ethnically diverse staff. It requires the district advisory committee to recommend to the school board strategies to ensure the curriculum and learning and work environments are inclusive and respectful.
Section 8 it relates to screening students for dyslexia. It's a little bit different from what was heard in committee. It requires a school district to screen for characteristics of dyslexia. All students identified as not reading at grade level by the end of kindergarten, first and second grade, and requires a district to screen for characteristics of dyslexia students in third grade or higher who demonstrate a reading difficulty unless there's already been a different reason that's been identified for that reading difficulty. Sections 9 to 17 are discipline provisions from the governor's bill. And I'll go through those. Section 9 has a definition of non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices. It defines that term as alternatives to removing a pupil from class or dismissing a pupil from class and lists a number of examples. These policies and practices require school officials to intervene in, direct, and support a pupil's behavior before removing the pupil from class or beginning dismissal proceedings. Section 10 defines pupil withdrawal agreements as verbal or written agreements between an administrator and parent to withdraw a student to avoid expulsion or exclusion dismissal proceedings and limits the term of those agreements to 12 months. Section 11 requires a school to use non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices before a dismissal proceeding or pupil withdrawal agreement unless there's immediate and substantial, the student would create immediate and substantial danger to self or other persons or property. Section 12 requires a school administrator to ensure that if the pupil is suspended for more than five consecutive school days, alternative education services are provided. Section 13 is just slightly different from what was heard in committee. It requires school officials to give suspended pupils a reasonable opportunity to complete schoolwork assigned during the suspension. And it notes that nothing in the subdivision limits the teacher's authority to assign alternative work for the completion of assignments during a suspension. Section 14 modifies the written notice requirements by requiring the notice of intent to exclude or expel the student to describe the non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices that were used, and requiring the department to post on its website a list of legal assistance resources. Section 15 requires an admission or readmission plan to address measures to improve the pupil's behavior and has some examples of those measures and requires parental involvement in the process. Section 16 requires the school board to report pupil withdrawal agreements and non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices to the department. And Section 17 requires this is the policies that school districts have to adopt, and it requires the district's policy to include non-exclusionary disciplinary policies and practices, as well, and has some agreements relating to pupil withdrawal agreements and continuing work during while the pupil is out. Section 18 is the student journalism and student expression section. Subdivision 1 defines some of the terms used in the section, including school-sponsored media and student journalist. Subdivision 2 describes the protected conduct for students and a media advisor. Subdivision 3 has the expression that is not protected and authorizes a school district authorizing a prior restraint of a school-sponsored media when that speech is not protected. And Subdivision 4 requires districts and charter schools to adopt and post a student journalist policy consistent with this section. Section 19 requires the school board to provide kindergarten free of charge to all students in the district. Section 20 modifies the accreditation requirement for an Opportunities Industrialization Center. Section 21 eliminates the income verification requirement for early learning scholarships if the child is in need of protective services or foster care or is homeless. Sections 22 to 27 change the term vocational or school to work to career and technical. Section 28 requires that the American Indian Education Parent Advisory Committee submit the reasons, its reasons for non-concurrence with educational programs for American Indian students offered by the school board directly to the board. Brings us to Article 3. Section 1, on increasing the percentage of teachers of color and American Indian teachers in Minnesota. In subdivision 2, it states a goal saying that the percentage of teachers who are of color or American Indian in Minnesota should increase at least 2 percentage points per year. And subdivision 3 states that there are no rights, this does not confer any rights or a claim. Subdivision 4 requires PELSB to collaborate with other state agencies to summarize reports from programs that are administering programs to increase the racial and ethnic diversity of teacher workforce. Subsection 2 modifies definition of teacher to include a person with a permission from PELSB. Section 3 modifies the definition of field, and that makes it synonymous with licensure area. Section 4 eliminates examples of types of teacher preparation programs. Section 5 modifies the definition of teacher preparation program. Section 6 adds 3 members to the board to the PELSB board. Section 7 modifies the board composition. Section 8 eliminates the requirement relating to board office space. Section 9 prohibits a public employer of a member of PELSB from reducing the member's compensation or benefits for the member's absence from employment while on board business. Section 10 requires PELSB to adopt rules under the Alternative Teacher Prep Program statute. Section 11 makes technical changes. Section 12 makes reading strategies requirement applicable to all program providers. Section 13 does the same for technology strategies. Section 14 eliminates obsolete language. Section 15 makes changes to the background check account. It eliminates an obsolete reference to the department and the requirement that the background check be performed by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Section 16 modifies the military license fee. Section 17 modifies the background check requirement, and it eliminates language allowing PELSB or BOSA to issue a license pending completion of a background check. Section 18 makes the licensure portfolio available only for Tier 3 license candidates and strikes language regarding the portfolio fees. That's going to be moved somewhere else in statute, so that section is cross-referenced there. Section 19 limits a Tier 1 license to 1 renewal unless there's good cause for additional renewals. Section 20 allows a teacher with a Tier 1 license to be included in the teacher's bargaining unit. Section 21 eliminates the coursework requirement for Tier 2 candidates and modifies other Tier 2 eligibility requirements. Section 22 limits the Tier 2 license to renewals. Section 23 eliminates one path towards a Tier 3 license that's based on 3 years of teaching experience with a Tier 2 license without being placed on improvement process. Sections 24... Section 24 is similar to Section 26. Both modify the mentorship requirements and prevent teachers with Tier 3 or 4 licenses from being required to serve as a mentor. Section 25 eliminates the requirement that a candidate for a Tier 4 license provide the most recent summative evaluation to show that the teacher was not placed on improvement process. Section 27, teacher licensure assessments, allows an employing school or district to verify through the teacher's performance the teacher's skills in reading, writing, and math so the teacher can obtain a Tier 4 license. It allows pedagogy to be assessed through a performance assessment and requires testing centers to provide monthly opportunities for untimed skills exams. Sections 28 and 29 go together. Those relate to the cultural competency training. So the board would require the board to adopt rules requiring teachers renewing Tier 3 or 4 licenses to have cultural competency training. Section 30 allows the board to approve all teacher prep programs just changing by taking out that reference to colleges or universities, so it would be all teacher prep programs. Section 31 modifies the grounds for revocation, suspension, or denial of a license. It allows the board to issue non-disciplinary corrective action for certain conduct, and it adds some grounds there, including engagement in sexual conduct or contact with a student. In paragraph B, it amends the list of offenses, where if a teacher, if the board receives a certified copy of a conviction of these offenses, then the board must refuse to issue, renew, or must automatically revoke the teacher's license without right to a hearing. So there's some additional language in that paragraph. In paragraph D, it requires the board, both Pelsby and BOSA, whichever has jurisdiction, requires the board to review and allows the board to refuse to issue, renew, or revoke a teacher's license to teach when it receives a certified copy of a conviction of domestic violence offenses or embezzlement. And paragraph E allows the board to suspend a license pending an investigation into a report of conduct. That will be grounds for revocation under paragraph B, which had that list of convictions. Section 32 modifies mandatory reporting requirements by adding a superintendent, a charter school board, or charter school executive director, or charter school authorizer. So they would have to report to Pelsby or BOSA when a teacher is charged, when a teacher is discharged or resigns for particular reasons. Section 33 adds, that's the portfolio fees requirement. Section 34 requires a superintendent or charter school, superintendent of a district or a charter school director to provide the school board with the number of teachers in each school building with a tier one, two, three, or four license. And the school board has to publish this data. Section 35 relates to community education teachers, the ones that are required to have licenses, which is the AVE and the ECFE teachers. It includes those teachers within the definition of teacher under the continuing contract and tenure statutes. Section 36 limits the placement, 36 and 7, 37 are the same. One is for continuing contract, the other one for tenure districts. And it limits the placement of students in the classroom of a teacher with a tier 1 or 2 license. Section 38, currently the Code of Ethics for Teachers is in rule and is adopted by Pelsby. This section moves it from rule to statute. It adds language prohibiting a teacher from engaging in sexual conduct or contact with a student and allowing a teacher to delegate authority to non-licensed personnel in accordance with law. Section 39. Sections 39, 40, 41, and 42, and 43 all relate to grants to prepare American Indian teachers. So Section 39 requires grantees to enter into contracts with tribal technical and community colleges and four-year institutions to identify and provide grants to students interested in education. Section 40 removes student loans from the list of allowable uses for grants. Section 41 makes technical changes relating to that change with respect to loans. Section 42 amends the eligibility for scholarships. And Section 43 requires grantees to and their contracted institutions to provide scholarships to students progressing toward educational goals in any area of licensure. There's also a requirement on how grants should be used. Section 44 amends the teacher mentorship statute. It encourages a school district to develop mentoring programs for teachers who are American Indian or in license shortage areas. It allows a coalition of schools, teachers, or non-licensed educators to apply for grant funds. Adds a commitment to retain teachers who are American Indian as grant criteria and has a reporting requirement. Section 45 expands eligibility for grants to develop an introduction to teaching courses. Section 46 allows an achievement and integration plan to include recruitment and retention of certain staff from racial and ethnic backgrounds represented in the student population. Section 47 amends the statute on student teacher candidate grants in shortage areas. It requires candidates to be student teachers and amends the definition of licensed shortage areas, amends the eligibility for grants, and establishes priority for candidates who are of color or American Indian and have made satisfactory academic progress. Section 48, 49, 50, 51, and 52 all relate to the teacher shortage loan forgiveness program. These sections amend eligibility requirements, also amend eligibility for loan forgiveness program, shifts responsibility for identifying shortage areas from MTE to Pelsby. Pelsby now does the supply and demand report and requires Pelsby to identify racial or ethnic groups experiencing a teacher shortage. There's also commissioner amends the commissioner verification requirement and increases the maximum loan forgiveness amount. Section 53 adds BOSA to the definition of non-health related licensing boards in Chapter 214. Chapter 214 governs licensing boards and has requirements like reporting and general board procedures. Section 54 allows the Commissioner of Human Services to contract with Pelsby to conduct background studies and obtain background study data. Section 55 requires law enforcement to inform Pelsby or BOSA when it determines that one of the board's licensees has physically abused, sexually abused, or neglected a child, and requires law enforcement to work collaboratively with the board. Section 56 requires the Commissioner of Education, who investigates maltreatment reports in schools, so it requires the Commissioner to provide the full investigative file in a determination of maltreatment to the board that licenses the person that's investigating. Section 57 adds certain offenses. There's currently a list of offenses that if a court determines that the person who is convicted is licensed to teach, the court has to send a copy of the conviction to Pelsby or BOSA within 10 days. Section 58 is a repealer. So that repeals the session law relating to portfolio fees, and that's just moving it around in statute. Paragraph B repeals the course requirement for Tier 2 candidates. And C, that's the rule relating to teacher code of ethics because that's moving into statute. Article 4, special education. Section 1 amends the requirements for an individualized education program. And that section, if you see the language on page 74, on lines 30 to 33, that incorporates two bills, one allowing an IEP team to eliminate benchmarks or short-term objectives except for students who take alternative assessments, and then also allows the district to include in the IEP the student's performance on general or district-wide assessments related to the student's educational needs. And then on page 76, there's a new paragraph D. That's the language from the bill that allows the school district to conduct a functional behavior assessment as a standalone evaluation without doing a comprehensive evaluation of the student. Section 2 requires the prior written notice to state that a parent who objects to a proposal or refusal in the notice, the parent can then... There's a new option for the parent to identify the specific part of the proposal or refusal that the parent is objecting to and requesting a meeting with the appropriate members of the IEP team. Section 3, the conciliation conference, requires the district to have a meeting of the IEP team when a parent who objects to a proposal or requests the meeting. It requires the district to hold the conference within 10 calendar days of when the district receives the request for the conference rather than from when the district receives the parent's objection. Section 4 allows a student who receives special education services to participate in the ADSIS program. That's the alternative delivery of specialized instructional services. That's normally for students who don't have IEPs. Section 5, 6, and 8, and 9 all relate to the recoding of the intermediate school district statutes from Chapter 136D to Chapter 123C. Section 7 requires the Commissioner of Education to appoint a working group to make recommendations for improving alignment between state guidance and federal law requirements on prior written notice. Section 8 requires the Commissioner to amend the rule to allow but not require an IEP to report a student's performance on assessments. And Article 5, Health and Safety. Section 1 encourages school districts and charters to provide mental health instruction starting in the fourth grade, so that's beginning earlier than previously the statute, and requiring the Commissioner of Education to provide districts and schools with certain resources. Section 2 is sexual health education. Subdivision 1 requires the Commissioner of Education to use rulemaking to adopt a model program or programs and make that program accessible to districts and charters. Subdivision 2 requires districts and charters to implement a comprehensive sexual health education program starting the 21-2022 school year. And what's different here from what was heard in committee was that rather than a district getting approval for a program, the superintendent of the district or person having control over a charter instead submits to the commissioner an annual assurance of compliance with sexual health education requirements. Subdivision 3 states that sexual health instruction is subject to parental curriculum review requirements already in statute. Section 3 is the Title IX compliance language requiring the Department of Education to provide districts guidance and other resources regarding sexual violence in Title IX. Subdivision 2 requires training. Sections 4 and 9 are from the bill amending school district requirements storing drugs and unclaimed drugs and medicines. So Section 4 requires the parent of a student to whom school personnel administer drugs or medicine at the parent's request or because it's in the IEP to inform the school if the drug or medicine is a controlled substance. And then there's requirements there relating to transport and the request specifying that the parent must retrieve the drug when requested by the school. And Section 5 relates to how the district would dispose of the unclaimed drugs or medicines. Section 6 allows a student to have and use sunscreen at school without a prescription or note from professionals. Section 7 modifies the definition of sexual abuse. That's for purposes of investigating maltreatment of minors. And Section 8 requires the Commissioner of Education to report to the legislature on sexual health education programs. Article 6, facilities. The first two sections relate to lead in school drinking water, both the frequency of testing and the reporting. They're slightly different from what was in the governor's bill. It requires district, it adds, they still add charter schools, and requiring a district or charter that finds lead to formulate, make publicly available, and implement a plan consistent with established guidelines and recommendations. And the reporting requirement requires districts to remediate and to make the water source unavailable until hazard has been minimized. Section 3 is on disposing of school surplus computers, allowing a district to sell or give the used computers or tablets to students. Section 4 on radon testing is a little bit different from both Representative Claflin's bill and the governor's language. It still adds the charter schools to the plan, and as well as the state academies and the Purpich Center, and requires a district or charter to adopt a radon testing schedule that tests every building serving students at least every 5 years. Specifies a requirement for how tests must be conducted. And Section 5 adds charter schools to the definition of municipality for purposes of the contract law. Article 7 is just one section, and that is the school meals policies. That was Representative Juergens' Respectful Meals Bill, requiring school districts to adopt school meals policies relating to prohibiting withdrawal of meals served to students, ensuring that students eligible for free and reduced price lunch are always served a reimbursable meal. Subdivision 1A, that's just a technical change. Subdivision 4 prohibits a participant from denying school lunch to a student who qualifies for free or reduced price lunch, regardless of whether the student has a meal balance. And Subdivision 5 requires participants to provide meals in a respectful manner and conform to the policy, and prohibits certain practices when the student has a balance. Article 8, state agencies. The first section modifies the duties of the dyslexia specialist at the Department of Education. And one, the difference between what was heard in committee and what's in here is there's new language, paragraph E, saying that nothing in the subdivision limits the ability of the specialist to do other dyslexia-related work as directed by the commissioner. Sections 2 and 3, Section 2 prevents the expiration of the school safety technical assistance center, which is set to take place this June 30th. And Section 3 does the same for the school safety technical assistance.
Oh, thank you very much, Ms. Parra, for that wonderful overview. And thank you, Madam Chair, for this comprehensive collection that you've put together. Members, at this time, are there any brief clarifying questions that you have about what is included in this bill? We're going to wait to talk about what's not included in this bill, but at this time, if there are any brief clarifying questions you have about what is in this bill, anyone? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Joachim, on page 12, line 2.23, in the citizenship course.
Please, Mr. Representative, would you speak into the microphone?
I'm usually not this
quiet.
Bashful. Sorry. Okay. On line 12.23, must include instruction on diverse cultures. I don't understand what that means. Could you clarify that, please?
Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Erdahl. I'm sorry, I meant to call you this week and to chat about that personally, too. We had talked briefly about having some cultural competency added into the civics curriculum, so that is just kind of to go along with what we're doing with the Teachers of Color and Indigenous Folks Act. We have that within there, more of a definition of diverse, making sure the diverse cultures are taught when teaching civics.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And while I'm not in disagreement with teaching cultural diversity, I think it might be better included in a more broad social studies course rather than civics, where we're basically talking about the Constitution.
Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Erdahl, when the Constitution was created, there were diverse cultures in this country, so I just want to make sure we're viewing it through all the lenses.
Rebuttal, Representative?
Madam Chair, can you give me an example of how would we teach that?
Chair Joachim?
Madam Chair, well, Representative Erdahl, I would leave that up to the curriculum and the curriculum that's set by teachers. It's a direction. I believe also other lines on there with, government citizenship, that's pretty broad as well.
Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Of course, we defined that in the world's best workforce, which isn't there anymore. But we'll have a more in-depth discussion later, okay?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, happy to.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Any other brief clarifying questions at this time? Oh, Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just noticed, I don't know if this was in the original original legislation or not, but there's some things about communication between law enforcement and Pelsby. And I just want to make sure that whether it's in the bill or not, that we're clear about that communication has to be confidential and that there's not a chance for it to leak. I think that's a huge concern for folks if information gets out about somebody before Pelsby has a chance to look at it or before any of that happens. And then there's some stuff in here about witness lists, too. So just want to be clear that when we're sharing this information, Pelsby doesn't necessarily have to contact those witnesses. Or I just want to, I don't know if that's part of their process, but just want to be clear about kind of what that includes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Wasilek. I know there is a lawyer here from Education Minnesota that's going to discuss that small provision. I wanted to expound on Representative Erickson's background check bill and make sure we are covering all of our bases. So I know that suggestion was part of a bill that we did not get a chance to hear. So good eye.
Representative Bennett, you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wondering, so starting on page 81, dealing with the sexual health education, it's my understanding that Representative Lippert, when Representative Lippert brought this into committee, that this was optional, this program was going to be optional, and I'm just wondering if you or nonpartisan staff could kind of show where this is optional.
Chair Yao King.
Madam Chair, Representative Bennett, we did not change the parent opt-out section that's in the underlying statute. And then also on 82.21 to 82.23, that's that reference to 120B.20, that it's still an opt-out.
Okay, Representative Bennett, Madam Chair, thank you. So just to clarify so I'm understanding it, it's not optional for school districts to do this or the department, but it is optional for parents. Parents may opt out. Is that how I'm understanding this?
Chair Yelke.
Madam Chair, Representative Bennett, you're accurate, but it is still optional to what curriculum the school district wants to use. And instead of prescribing and having the district go to the Department of Education, which was in the original bill, and get the blessings that they're not going to take one of the curriculums posted online, this actually allows them to have more latitude so that the superintendent just has to sign a letter of assurance saying that they will teach towards these standards, not standards, that's a bad word to use, towards these topics written here. And that was the suggestion from the Minnesota Rural Educators Association.
Thank you. Representative Bennett. Next, we have a question from Representative Herr.
I can forego. I was just going to comment on the culturally competent government class, but I don't need to.
Madam Chair, Representative Herr, feel free.
Thank you. Oh, I just wanted to say I appreciate it, Madam Chair. Thank you. I appreciate it that included in it. I think that even just something that seems very black and white around civics education can be really challenging for especially people of color who are coming into themselves at this age. And so even things around very basic things like this, like all men are created equal, right, is a very basic part of our Constitution. And that for people who understood that for their people at that time, their people were not created equal, were not seen as equal in the eyes of government and our country. And so I think that having that lens applied to our civics work is actually really critical. So I appreciate that that's in there.
Thank you, Representative Herr. Any other questions at this time? Looks like Representative Grunhagen would like to ask a clarifying question.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, if I'm understanding this correctly, in Article 3, Section 20, are we including the ECFE teachers in the bargaining unit?
I have, Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I have not had a chance to cross-reference the full bill. I have all my tabs on my separate articles, but not the big full bill. What page was that on?
It's on page 37.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This, Representative Grunhagen, this is Representative Lee's bill that we heard. And yes, that's the adult basic education and the early child and family education to include them in bargaining units as it's negotiated.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, my question would be, you know, why don't we leave this to local control? Because by doing this, you're going to increase costs for the district without additional funding. And, again, it usurps local control. If a district wants to include them, they can, and if they don't, and people are satisfied with that, or the individuals at negotiating table are satisfied, you wouldn't have to. Any thoughts?
Ms. Parra, you seem to have a good answer for this.
I just want to clarify that it's not changing the bargaining unit. It's changing continuing contract or tenure. It's saying that those teachers can get continuing contract or tenure. In some districts, the AB and ECFE teachers are already in the same bargaining unit as the K-12 teachers.
Representative.
Okay.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is to the bill's author. On lines 41.27 and 41.28.
Yes.
I'm just wondering what the definition of non-disciplinary corrective action is.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I think I'll let Ms. Parra answer that.
Ms. Parra?
Madam Chair, representatives, the board may take a variety of actions there. I think non-disciplinary would mean it wouldn't be a suspension or a revocation. I think Pelsby, the executive director of Pelsby is here, might be better able to answer that question.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I'm wondering if that disciplinary action would be public, like much of the other disciplinary actions are, whether that's a stipulation agreement or any other disciplinary action by the board.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, it's my understanding that when Pelsby is doing the investigating, it is not, and then what is put forward in the public is after a decision has been made, but I will let Mr. Luizzi answer that.
Mr. Luizzi, please state your name and share your response, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Alex Liuzzi, Executive Director of the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board. So any action that the board takes that is a non-disciplinary action would not be public.
Representative Scott.
So thank you, Madam Chair. Well, that's troubling to me because it seems like, we're trying to hide something here. And one of the issues that could create is if a teacher has multiple of those and then switches districts and is a repeat quote unquote offender, and and the new hiring entity wouldn't have any idea because none of the information would be public. So I find that very troubling. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, this could be as simple as having a teacher need to have a little bit more follow-up on with a mentor or mentoring instructor on how to approach a classroom. So it's really, non-disciplinary action is relatively minor when it comes to, from what my understanding. So it's not something that is affecting their license. Is that accurate, Mr. Lindsay?
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, well, it's under the paragraph of grounds for revocation, suspension, or denial. And so I think it's an overly broad term, and it's directly addressing when a teacher's license could be revoked, suspended, or denied. So I think it's of utmost importance that we get clear direction on what exactly this means.
Madam Chair,
we can talk offline and be more than happy in my author's amendment to take it out if it's bothering.
One more question, Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I notice on page 42 when they talk about the reasons for refusing to renew, et cetera, a license, and I'm looking at the paragraph on page 43 that talks about some other sort of convictions, and I'm wondering, I don't see anything in here, I just want to clarify, is there an option for, it says there's not an option for a hearing under paragraph B, but is there an option for a hearing under paragraph D at all, or where would that come in after the investigation? I guess I'm not clear on how that process works, so if there could be some clarification.
I'll have Mr. Luizzi answer that.
I'm going to have, Madam Chair,
Mr. Lazy.
I'll have to follow the cross-references. I'm sure there's some actually experts at the table that know a little bit closer than I. I do know there are sort of two sections in here. There's the auto-revoke sections, and those are not do not receive a hearing. And then there's other sections that say the board may review, must review, but then may take some action, and those would be there'd be the ability to appeal or to have a hearing in those situations. So I think this is relating to trying to evidence that one paragraph and not the other.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that's already part of Pelsby's process in this then, where if it's not a must, then they already have that as a built-in part of their process?
Mr. Luisi.
Correct, yes.
All right. Well, seeing no more questions at this time, Madam Chair, will we be taking our quick break and then coming back, or will we continue?
Members, I guess it's up to you. Would you prefer to go through about an hour of testimony and then take a break, or take a break now? I'm thinking maybe an hour of testimony and then a break. So I think I'm seeing some nods because I still think we're still kind of close to people having eaten breakfast. So let's wait until people are good and hungry before we take a break.
Okay. Madam Chair, we will exchange places then.
Yes. Thank you. Getting my paperwork all settled. And I think I also forgot to, when moving the bill originally in front of us, to instruct nonpartisan staff to amend the title accordingly and to make necessary technical and conforming changes. So we'll also add that to our motion when we adopt. Thank you. Right, members, I just have to grab my list of folks that have signed up to testify. And I think we're going to have MDE go first. And then we have on deck, we have Denise Dietrich and then Scott Kroonquist. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning. Caitlin Snyder, Government Relations, Minnesota Department of Education. First, I would like to thank the committee and the chair for bringing forward a comprehensive set of proposals that focus on students and educators. Thank you for including the majority of the governor's bill, including language to protect students in dismissal proceedings. We feel like these are very strong protections for our students. And making sure that these students are learning in safe and healthy environments by having school sites test for lead and radon. We understand the delicate nature of school safety assessments, and MDE remains committed to working with our partners at DPS and the Department of Human Rights to offer best practices and resources to help support our students and schools and to help prevent crises. Thank you for including the respectful lunch language, although we would note that allowing 60 days for a response leaves students waiting to remedy their lunch situation for quite some time. The governor recommends editing 60 days to 30 days on line 98.9. We particularly appreciate the focus on teacher quality and recruitment in this bill and want to build an intentional system of teacher preparation and induction where each step builds on each other, because we want Minnesota to be a place where no one enters education with the goal of leaving. The commissioner is dedicated to working with the committee to developing a system to develop and retain high-quality educators and are particularly appreciative of the focus on mentoring in this bill. We would also like to work with the committee to have a larger conversation about the vision for education in Minnesota and what tools we want our graduates to leave the schools with. Changing graduation requirements may force unintended choices for students, like making it trickier to take PSEO or CTE classes or earn an IB degree. A potential unintended consequence of the civics language requirement could be fewer credits in civics overall as schools move from a system of having a full year in ninth grade to just a course for credit in 11th or 12th grade. This is a potential unintended choice to consider as this language moves forward. In Article 3, Section 34, District Reporting on Tier 1, 2, and 3 and 4 license, this requires districts to report to MDE the range of licenses available in each school site for their teachers. MDE does not have a data reporting mechanism that would fit this requirement. We would recommend either working with PELSB for this data reporting or having this information reported locally. In Article 3, Section 56, this has MDE send the full investigative folder to either BOSA or PELSB, whichever is the licensing authority. MDE is currently negotiating a data sharing agreement on this issue. However, we would prefer to redact student victim personally identifiable information and have a consideration for potentially redacting witnesses as well to protect their information. Article 4, Section 1, relating to special education paperwork reduction. MDE supports reductions in special education paperwork that are supported by parents, districts, and advocates. Article 5, Section 2, sexual health education. MDE looks forward to treating these standards in the same manner as the other standards. And to best support this goal with fidelity, we would like to request a health specialist, particularly for the technical assistance to school districts. Article 5, Section 3, school harassment and sex discrimination. This would require MDE to provide technical assistance to Title IX coordinators. Currently, we have, I believe, 0.4 in FTE that is supporting Title IX coordinators across the state. So again, to support this requirement with fidelity, we would request another specialist in this area. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Snyder. Ms. Dietrich. Ms. Dietrich, go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Denise Dietrich, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota School Boards Association. And thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today on this omnibus bill. Chair Joachim, you gave a little bit of your numbers assessment of prior to the bill, and so I'll just add one number to that. There are 33 references to school boards in the bill, so it's very appropriate that we are here today. For today, I would like to divide my testimony into three different areas: provisions of the bill we support, provisions we oppose, and there are a number of requirements that we believe should remain under the jurisdiction of locally elected school boards, or at the least, fully funded. So to begin with, I want to thank you and the committee for the time that you dedicated to the topic of paperwork reduction in your hearings. We strongly support the 6 provisions in Article 4 that will help reduce the burden of paperwork for special education teachers. It is time to make movement in this area, and your bill reflects that. So a big thank you for that. We also want to thank you for including your pre-Labor Day start date for the next 2 school years, the initiatives to increase teachers of color in Minnesota. However, we just add to that that I believe some of those initiatives will cost money, so hopefully we're working with the finance bill and Chair Daphne on that. And then expanding the duties of the dyslexia specialist as the preferred way to meet the needs of dyslexic students in the state of Minnesota. We applaud affirming the ability to negotiate teacher retention and protection from the ULA process, and we would even suggest that you go a little bit further and protect some other type of teaching positions. So fortunately, we have provided public testimony on the provisions that we oppose in the bill, but for the record, I will mention them again today. We oppose any changes to the tiered licensure system before our school boards have the opportunity to work with the new system long enough to bring real data to the conversation. Once again, in summary, we ask the question, should we be making changes to a system that has been in place for less than 5 months? We understand the difficulty PELSB is experiencing in getting members to fulfill all of the board's responsibilities, but we would submit if the number of the board members is increased, that one or more of those members should be a school board member, and one or more of those should be a superintendent. Currently, we have a superintendent, and they alternate outstate and metro area. We oppose the reduction of electives. Local school boards are designing high schools to prepare all students for career college pathways, and they need the flexibility at the local level to continue that work. New course requirements in government and personal finance will cost the school district's money, and that will provide for a greater statewide structure and less local control. In the area of comprehensive sex education, we believe that that should remain a locally determined program and curriculum. And we are in opposition to ECFE and ABE teachers being subject to the bargaining unit. And so there are a number of provisions that we would consider new requirements and possibly funding needed for those. The first is dyslexia screening. There are costs associated with yearly screening. The sexual health education curriculum and model, we believe that school districts would need new resources in order to implement. Lead in water and radon testing, the notification and the remediation will require costs, require funding. On the religious holidays portion of your bill, there is a new policy and yearly notification. We would like clarification if that can be included in the student handbook once a year and if that would qualify as yearly notification. The non-exclusionary disciplinary policies, we will look to the guidance of the school administrators to help us with that, but would like to continue the discussion. The compulsory attendance from age 7 to age 6, one may predict that more students will be attending our schools and that the state will now be responsible for the 0.4 funding for each student. The new reporting under listing the number of teachers in a building who hold tiered licensure under 1, 2, 3, or 4, we believe is a new requirement, and we don't think that it is necessary. It may pit teacher against teacher. And then last, it is the requirement to modify the definition of textbooks to include teacher's guides. We wonder if that would be an additional cost to school districts, or would the state be reimbursing for that. So MSBA thanks you for your time, and we hope that we can continue to be a resource as you refine the provisions in this bill. With that, I'll conclude my comments. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Dietrich. There's a few questions I have for you, but I can take them offline. Perfect. Thank you. And then next we have Mr. Kronquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And let me start out, too, by also thanking you, Madam Chair, and the members of the committee for your work this session, for meeting with us, and for hearing several of the bills that we were interested in. And we look forward to continuing to work with you the rest of the way. I would like to just start out by saying that before each session, we survey our members, our school board members, and our superintendents, ask them what their finance priorities are and what their policy priorities are. And generally, the number one policy priority that comes back is they direct me to ask you to please don't enact any new unfunded mandates. And that was certainly true this year. In fact, it was not even close. The number two policy priority was way, way behind that one. Let me also say that we understand this is the policy committee, and so you still need to send this bill to the finance division, and we'll find out what kind of funding comes with any new requirements there. And I also want to say that we understand that each of these new requirements comes with the best of intentions. We understand you want to do good things for kids, and it brings up the quote that many of you are probably familiar with, the notorious famous bank robber Willie Sutton. When he was asked, why do you rob banks? He said, that's where the money is, right? And we understand that's why schools see a lot of requirements, because that's where the kids are. We get that. That said, there are only so many hours in the day, and it's hard to keep putting additional requirements on top of staff, especially without resources. So let me highlight a few things. Ms. Dietrich covered many of the things that I would mention. We very much support the components related to increasing the teachers of color. That's been identified as one of our top priorities in our legislative platform, and we thank you for those provisions and look forward to continuing to work with you on that. Also, Madam Chair, thank you so much. And Representative Christensen worked on the Labor Day start bill. As you know, our preference would be that school boards always have the ability to determine their calendar. But given the calendar for the next couple years, the 2021 and 21-22 school year, when Labor Day comes so late, we greatly appreciate the relief there. As Ms. Dietrich mentioned, we strongly support the special education paperwork reduction. You've heard that over and over from your staff, from school district staff, excuse me, and teachers, and the progress that we could make there reflected in the bill would be a huge help. A couple of the concerns we have, the graduation requirements, with regard to the government and citizenship, the primary concern there really is that it has to be in the 11th or 12th grade. That is going to cause some of your districts some problems because they will have to realign curriculum. They are now covering some of those benchmarks and standards in 9th or 10th grade. And actually, of more concern then would be the half credit required for the personal finance. As Ms. Dietrich outlined, that really comes at having to lower than the number of electives that is available to students. And we actually already hear from students who don't feel like they have enough elective opportunities. We do have some concerns regarding the dyslexia requirements. And Representative Edelson has been very good to work with, and I know she's indicated she's willing to continue working with the stakeholders. The feedback that I have gotten is that the K-2 provisions are pretty workable, and that I think most of our districts are able to accommodate what's required there. They might be interested in adding that language that's in the K-3 area where if a different reason has already been identified for the reading difficulty, then is there really a need to continue to screen? And then the bigger concerns that I've heard from our member districts are the screening requirements at third grade and beyond. And we really could end up in a situation where we're just screening students year after year after year, and we're not sure of the benefit, actually, of that. Then also, I do have to express our opposition to the changes in the tiered licensure. We also agree that it's a law that is just going into effect, and we really should let it settle for a few years at least and gather some data before embarking on changes, and especially in terms of eliminating some of the current pathways that would be allowed under that to help us fill those hard-to-fill positions and attract more teachers of color. So I know you got a lot more to hear from, Madam Chair and members, so I will stop there and thank you again and look forward to continuing to work with you.
Thank you, Mr. Kuhnquist. I have next Mr. Fred Nolan.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'm Fred Nolan, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Rural Education Association, and I'd like to testify on three aspects of the bill. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify. There's many new requirements in this bill, as my colleague Scott Kuhnquist and Denise Dietrich have pointed out. And while your intent is to improve opportunities for kids and ensure healthy experience in school, I want to highlight two provisions that I hope you'll keep working with us on. The first is Article 2, Section 8, the provisions regarding screening dyslexic students. I want to second what Scott Kuhnquist said about adding the provision that screening in Ks 1, 2, and 3 should have the language unless a different reason for reading difficulty has been identified. That we have K-2 students who have been through an IEP, through ECSE, and are also ELL students. And so the dyslexia screening may be inappropriate or redundant for them. And my second ask is to consider some limitation on the amount of dyslexia screening one student can be referred to in total. My concern is that repeated screenings may have an unintended consequence for historically disadvantaged students. Given the unfortunate and significant lower proficiency rate for these kids, they're likely to get screened for dyslexia at a much higher rate. Instead of helping these kids, repeated referrals to dyslexia screening could reinforce theirs and other negative perceptions of their inability to learn to read proficiently. That'd be an awful unintended consequence. Also, the terms used in the section, such as not reading at grade level, demonstrate reading difficulty, and different reasons for reading difficulty are all non-technical terms. To some degree, they're common parlance, but I see a lot of confusion down the road and potential for unnecessary conflict at the local level. For example, does not reading at grade level mean reading at least 1 year below grade level on a normed assessment, or does it mean not proficiently reading at grade level? There's a huge difference in the number of students you catch in those two ways of characterizing that. I understand there's a need for more dyslexia screening. We all want kids all to read. And over time, we'll need to revisit these provisions and work closely with MDE on implementation and best practices to ensure we're helping students and not hindering them. Moving on, the changes proposed to teacher licensure, and I'd like to be brief about this. We're talking about Article 3, Sections 19 through 25, to be specific. The new tiered licensure system was put into place because the old one was broken. And while you've improved the system in a few places, several of the proposed licensure changes will close pathways for desperately needed non-traditional educators to make their way into the classroom. Adding more uncertainty to renewing a Tier 1 CTE license will absolutely harm our recruitment and retention in this area. You took testimony from a CTE teacher in law enforcement who left a civil service position with a pension to work in school. By striking the clear language of the current law that a Tier 1 CTE teacher can indefinitely renew in a particular school district, you're going to make these valuable mid-career choices for individuals next to impossible, and that's going to be a loss for our students. Likewise, striking the ability for a person with a master's degree to be a Tier 2 teacher could harm our ability to fill concurrent enrollment courses, especially once the HLC requirements are fully implemented. The Higher Learning Commission credits higher education institutions in Minnesota did us no favors in this area, and we need this Tier 2 option to keep this highly valued college and the school's courses available to students after September 1, 2022. And finally, I want to thank the committee and the chair for including in the Article 5, Section 2 on sexual health education the requirement that superintendent provide assurance that the topics are met, rather than going through an approval process with MDE. With that, I'll conclude my testimony and be available for questions now or later. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nolan. And then I have Mr. Amoroso and Mr. Aronson. And then I think what we may do then is take some questions briefly for the folks that have testified so far, the six, and then we may break for lunch. So, Mr. Amoroso, state your name for the record, please, and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gary Amoroso, Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. I want to thank the Chair and the committee for their work over the course of the last 2 months. I firmly believe that everybody in this room has the best interest of children at heart, and the challenge, of course, is finding ways that we can come together to make sure that we make good decisions for our students. But I do thank you for your efforts and look forward to continue working with you as we continue through the session. In terms of things that we're very pleased with in the bill, I do appreciate the fact that you've given us some relief of the school calendar for the 2 years that we have the challenge of Labor Day starting so late, so we appreciate that. And as a side note, would love to see that made permanently down the road, but we'll talk about that another day. We're also very thankful for the paperwork reduction phases of the bill. There's been a lot of work on that really over the last couple of years, and we're very pleased that it has made it into your bill. We're very pleased with the conversation about trying to increase the number of teachers of color in our state. We need to do that, and we're very pleased to continue working with you on that. We're pleased to see the information and the pieces regarding teacher shortage and loan forgiveness. Anything we can do to make it more palatable for either our current teachers to move forward or to encourage other teachers or other people to go into the profession, we're excited about that. In terms of some of the concerns that we have, many of what you've heard from the other associations are concerns that we share. We're concerned about the possible unintended consequence of limiting student choice by taking the electives from 7 down to 6.5. We certainly want to look at all these ideas and say they're all good, but what is the impact? When do we start losing local control? It seems as though that we nudge forward and forward each year by doing a few little things, and then all of a sudden our districts aren't going to have a say in much of what is going on in their systems. So that credit piece, I think, is damaging to students. I would agree with Mr. Grunquist. If we could take that provision away from having to have the civics in 11th or 12th grade, that would make that more palatable than it currently is. We all believe in public finance. I think it's important. But again, that takes away opportunities for kids that might be in their best interest to explore something else that would help them for their future. You know how we feel about the ECFE and ABE piece with putting those individual professionals into the seniority piece, concerned with that. The tiered licensure piece, I think we've been involved from July 1. We're now in March, so we've had less than 9 months or 9 months of really actually seeing this implemented, and can it work? This was done in a bipartisan fashion a year ago and implemented. So we'd like to, or 2 years ago, we'd like to see it have a chance to get some legs and really see what the impact would be. There are a few other things, but we'll leave it at that. But again, we're very thankful that the committee has come together and had made some proposals. We know that the finance piece will hopefully be coming down the road, and hope that many of the things that are considered unfunded mandates by many of the organizations can be addressed. With that, Madam Chair, I also want to do a quick thank you because I wasn't here last week. I was at our state conference. I wanted to thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Christensen and the committee for moving forward House File 1982, the snow day bill. And we're hopeful that we can still get some relief for our districts. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Amoroso. Mr. Aronson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thought I'd get up here quickly since I'm between you and lunch. Never a good place for a speaker to be. And by the way, I'm Roger Aronson. I represent the Elementary and Secondary Principals Association. Gary Amoroso mentioned their conference last week. Jan Moore was honored last week, who was the former executive director of the Board of School of Administrators. And I think it's appropriate. We all appreciated her service very much and thought that award was most well-deserved. A few comments on the bill. Obviously, we're going to join in the comments of our colleagues in other areas. And as you can see, we talk about these continuously as a group, circulate ideas, things that maybe people, other folks haven't seen to discuss. And so, for example, we would join in the comments of Mr. Kronquist and Ms. Dietrich on dyslexia. We've all talked about those. I might say as an observation, this is of keen interest to the elementary school principals. We have a constituency here that wants some answers, and there is always a struggle with what the language actually says in response to those constituencies, and I think that's what you're finding from us. We all acknowledge that these folks need some services. What's the best way to do it? In the discipline portions of the bill, you picked up several sections from the governor's policy bill. You made some changes that we requested, the makeup work changes here. We appreciate that you made those. Some of the things that you left out as well, there's a few issues that we still continue to have. We think you ought to adopt the language that was in the final omnibus bill last year, and we'll keep working on that with you to see if we can't make that happen. We appreciate the Labor Day school start issue here. That's going to continue to be an issue, and we'll see if we can't work that out in the future. We had a very long and lengthy discussion about school newspapers the other day. The group is more than happy to leave that issue to me, Madam Chair, given the strength of the authorship and the topic on that. But we want to look at some other solutions on that as we go through the process to see that school newspapers continue to be a positive activity for the students that are involved in them. And we will have some ideas for you as you go through with that, and we appreciate the opportunity to have that robust debate. I think we all have the same interests at mind in the end. We agree with our colleagues on the teacher licensure issues. This changed significantly a couple years ago. It took a lot to get people ramped up to make this work, and we're still working at that, and letting the dust settle and letting us get our handle on this is a very good idea at this point. The curriculum issues, those continue to be some challenges for us. We think you ought to let local boards decide whether or not personal finance ought to be a required graduation requirement for people getting out. Let them make those elective issues locally. I think you'll find out that will serve your interests as well when you go home to talk to your constituents and say, hey, this is up to you rather than deciding it here. One size will not necessarily fit all on that, and I think you'll find that. Representative Erdahl's citizenship language has changed again. we need some certainty on those pieces. It is unusual to put those languages that you're using there, those pieces of language, in the graduation requirements, and so that's a little bit different for us. So we'll need to talk about that a little bit more and see where we can end up on that. We really do appreciate working with this committee. It is pretty important work to do. It's hard to pass legislation, my observation about that and our observation is that's a good thing. When we make it hard, it ends up better in the end. And so this process, I think, is frankly on track to serve us all very well. And we thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for every courtesy that you've extended us. So in addition, your staff does an awfully good job of when we make a request to be on a testifying list and following up on that. And that is noticed by all of us. And we deeply appreciate that. It makes practicing on this side of the table much easier.
Thank you, Mr. Aronson. And I know I appreciate our staff greatly, too. So I think what we're going to do is have members ask any questions of the six that have just testified, and then we are going to move to lunch, and then we'll have the other testifiers up that have signed up to testify. Any member questions for those who have already testified? None at all. Matt, Representative Hewitt?
I don't know who can answer, but I just want to make sure that I get this clear, because I'm hearing over and over again from the administrators that this could hamper this tier level that we're looking at, could impact their ability to bring in teachers of color. Can anybody come up and tell me why that would be?
Any of the administrators that spoke? Because I know we're going to talk. We have some other folks coming up to us.
Yeah, I just want to hear from
the administrators, yes.
Don't all run.
Anybody want to answer that, how they think that plays out? Specifically. They're deciding who's going to come up. I'm seeing two takers.
Oh, wow.
She's saying, yes, come in. Okay. So, Ms. Dietrich, state your name for the record and proceed.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Actually, I think Pelsby would be a better person to even address this. It is my understanding in the last Pelsby report that many of our teachers of color are under Tier 1 or Tier 2, and I think that is what we are interpreting as is that any changes to the Tier 1 or 2 system may provide barriers to teachers of color in our schools.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hewitt.
Sorry, I don't want to hear from Pelsby. I want to hear from you being the representative of the schools. Where do you see this being your obstacle or your hurdle in hiring people of color? We're talking.
I see more people approaching the table.
Right, there we go.
State your name for the record and proceed.
Members of the committee, Denise Dietrich for the Minnesota School Boards Association, we do have the data that our Tier 1 and Tier 2 teachers are many times teachers of color, or that is a pathway or an alternative pathway to get into the teaching profession for those people. And if we eliminate those pathways, we will have teachers of color as we have before, either coming to the state of Minnesota or trying to get into the profession and facing so many hurdles or barriers that they just stop.
Mr. Aronson, and then I see Mr. Walseth, and then I see Mr. Luizzi doing backup afterwards.
Sorry.
Nice batting order. All right, Mr. Aronson, just state your name for the record. Proceed. Or Amorosa, sorry.
Gary Amorosa, Executive Director, Minnesota Association of School Administrators. Part of the concern is just a conversation about the pathways. I think there was some language in the bill, and I apologize if I'm not correct, that I think the Tier 2 to Tier 3, there was some language that could be interpreted to eliminate the pathway for out-of-state teachers that are licensed and not currently involved in a Minnesota licensure program, that could preclude them. I may be inaccurate on that, but that'd be something that I've been hearing as a possibility. And then the conversation about the Tier 1 and 2, as Ms. Dietrich said, with our teachers of color, I've heard of and seen some data that shows that that could be damaging to those individuals, and not in a way that we believe that any of our candidates couldn't meet the standards over time. But I think all of you know we're in a shortage, and we need help today. We needed help yesterday. And so while it would take time potentially to have more of our candidates move through the system, our districts need support now. And we have challenges with hiring, and it's no longer just a challenge. I hear from our colleagues in Greater Minnesota, the superintendents, but I hear challenges from colleagues in the metro for certain areas and positions that they're having trouble getting people in. And so we in no way, shape, manner, or form are trying to downgrade qualifications or indicate that we don't respect the work needs to go into being an outstanding teacher. We support that. But we also are looking for pathways and empowering our school boards and our superintendents and administration to be able to make some decisions that would hopefully provide opportunities for additional people to be in our teaching profession.
Mr. Amoroso, the first part you mentioned about the wet licensure program, we are looking at fixing that language so it just doesn't say Minnesota. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Mr. Walseth, state your name for the record,
Madam
please.
Chair, Member Sam Walseth, lobbyist for the Minnesota Rural Education Association. I just want to add, too, and I know this is a little off of Representative Hewitt's question, but I think this issue is kind of starting to become a proxy for teachers of color. There are many other reasons why we needed this teacher licensure structure in place, not just to fill teachers of color, filling those gaps, but to get lots and lots of other folks into our schools and into our program. So I just get concerned that we're kind of boiling this licensure issue down to just a teacher of color issue. That's not just the only issue at stake here. We are trying to fill lots and lots of positions, career technical education positions. There's a lot of things going on with that tier licensure structure. So I know it's not exactly what Representative Hewitt asked about, but there's a lot more going on with the whole licensure structure and why we need it to stay in place.
Thank you, Mr. Walseth. And Mr. Luizzi, I think we're going to have you come up and clear some things up. I know you're slated to testify this afternoon, too, but then we're going to head out to lunch. Mr. Luizzi, state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Alex Luizzi, Executive Director of the Professional Educator License and Standards Board. Boy, stop making me say that over.
Pelsby, just say Pelsby.
Just Pelsby. So I have a lot of clarifications of different pieces that come up, and maybe even during the lunch break I can grab some of the testifiers. But specifically on that question, Representative, I believe you answered, Madam Chair, Gary Amoroso's point about the out-of-state teachers. This confusion was in the in a Tier 2 and out-of-state teacher or in Tier 2, there's the pathway that if you've completed teacher preparation but haven't met the other requirements of a Tier 3, which are the content and the pedagogy test, that you could receive a Tier 2. In the initial language, it said Minnesota-approved program. The amendment that we recommended was to change that to state so that an out-of-state teacher who comes here and hasn't maybe even taken the content or the pedagogy test could still be here on a Tier 2 license until they take those exams. So that would equate those two, and that concern would be gone. I believe Gary Amoroso also talked about the urgent need for teachers at this point. In the proposed changes, there would still be 8 years for an individual to evidence meeting the standards of effective practice on how to be a teacher before they would need to ask for good cause to the board, and so it could even go beyond those 8 years. Based on what we have heard from concerns and about the proposed changes, we have not found a single individual that is currently in tiered licensure that would not be able to teach next year, including teachers of color. And in the Tier 1 proposal, that moves it from 4 years to 2 years on a Tier 1. It keeps the exact same language of a good cause exemption, which just from a Pelsby's perspective, every district has to try to hire a higher licensed teacher for a Tier 1, and they have to fill out an application to show why, you know, where they posted. The good cause exemption piece would be an additional sentence or two in that application to show why they want this person to stay additional years or why they can't move up the tiers. So
thank
I hope that helps. We have more clarifications this afternoon.
Representative Hewitt, follow up.
So we're not going to, I mean, this isn't going to change a lot in our state. We're going to be able to still recruit teachers and move forward. I mean, we're just clearing up some language here, right? Or
Ms. Salizzi?
Madam Chair, from Pelsby's perspective, yes.
Thank you. Representative Bierman.
That was a lot of very good clarification that the teachers out of state is something I've heard so much about, and so I'm glad to hear that that seems to be dealt with in this. And then also what we just heard from Alex here, or Mr. Luigi, on the Tier 1, Tier 2, it's not so much the way I see it, it's not so much changing the Tier 1, Tier 2 as strengthening the Tier 1, Tier 2, making sure that those teachers are on track and are committed and there's some sort of evidence that they want to be there in the profession. So I'm happy to hear that all teachers right now who are in that Tier 1, Tier 2 would be okay if they're making progress, and that's sort of the fix in this as I see it. So as we continue to discuss it, I'm open to more evidence that there's a problem, but it seems like it's not a there's a lot of fear, it seems like, about the system being taken down after 5 months. It doesn't seem to be that way to me from what I've heard from testifiers. Thank you.
Representative Scott, I think you're the last one on the list, and we are going to continue the tiered licensing discussion after lunch, too, so I don't know if you want to ask your question now or wait until more testifiers.
If I could, Madam Chair, really quick here.
Yes, Representative Scott.
Thank you. Mr. Liuzzi, is that correct?
Liuzzi.
Okay. Well, am I to understand that you worked with the bill's author to change these licensing standards for this year?
Representative Scott, I'll answer that since I am the bill author, but there's two different provisions in here that talk about licensing. One is the Pelsby bill that I carried, which is mostly cleanup language and just a few tweaks. The other bill that's included is Representative Kunesh-Podein's bill, which is the more expansive one on tiered licensing. So Mr. Liuzzi just worked with me on the provisions from Pelsby that they recommended.
Oh, okay, Madam Chair, thank you for that clarification. So he didn't work with Representative Kunesh-Podein on her changes, is that correct?
Are you asking Mr. Liuzzi?
I guess I'm asking him.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Liuzzi?
No, we did not. 1415 was the bill that Pelsby put together for changes. What we did suggest, which is the amendment that I believe Representative Joachim was talking about for that will come on Wednesday, is to change the word Minnesota approved in Tier 2 to state approved. That was the only suggestion that we provided.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just concerned that I have always thought that Pelsby was an independent board and that it wouldn't be making policy with a member. So I can understand making a few changes and tweaks, but I'm glad to hear that they weren't a part of rolling back something that hasn't even been tried. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Scott. And with that, members, I think we are going to recess. Let's try to be back here by 1 o'clock to continue so we can get the rest of the testifiers in that are signed up for today, and then we'll have some more tomorrow. We're in recess.